Good afternoon, radio listeners. This is Dennis Carroll, and you're listening to Gospel Truth. We are greatly concerned about those in that condition that has just been sung about, the state of your heart, the state of your eyes. Is your heart cold and your prayers old? Well, you're going to answer that question that comes up in this next song.
What can be done for an old heart like mine? Soften it up with oil and wine. The oil is you, your spirit of love. Please wash me anew in the wine of your
Yes, the gospel of Jesus Christ does answer that question, what can be done with this old heart of mine? And as we look at this question week after week, we trust that you will see the solution and that your heart will become warmed towards God until it becomes a blazing fire of first love unto Him. And we will find that you and I together love God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and you love your neighbor as yourself, and we are truly becoming the church of God. Turn on your cassette recorders once again. It is time to think. This is Think Radio. Gospel Truth Radio Network is on the air. I said think, sober-mindedly, not flippantly, but think. Truth is now in session, so let's pay attention. Turn on your recorders, turn on your minds, and let us think together. We only have 1 hour each week to do a very important job together, and that is to think and look at the truth. The issue before us is what is true, not who is right. Not is Dennis Carroll right or wrong, not is any other person living or dead right or wrong, but what is the truth? Can we know it? And if we know it, then we should live by it, and we must live by it. You must listen each week for several months, my friend, before you will grasp the entire perimeters of this teaching and this understanding. So please do, week after week, tune in. And if you cannot tune in, have somebody record this for you and play it afterwards. And listen to it more than one time. You need your mind's attention drawn to these truths that we've taught for the last 2 weeks and that we will continue to teach in the coming broadcast. Our mailing address is Gospel Truth, Post Office Box 6322, Orange, California, 92613. This will be repeated at the end of the broadcast. I want to say hi to James up in Hesperia. Hello to the dudes down in Dana Point. And to many other people that are listening so far away from Long Beach. We're thankful for this opportunity to speak to millions of people that are out there that can hear this broadcast. What is our aim in this broadcast of Gospel Truth? Our aim is to change minds. Your mind. Many minds. Regarding teachings and beliefs that are not according to the truth, but have made the church impotent in our day. So we have a paradigm, a parable, an analogy. Some people say, well, that person just shot himself in the foot, meaning all that he had done to build up his particular case or to take his various actions, he completely destroyed it by shooting himself in the foot. Well, the church of our time is not shooting itself in the foot. It is shooting itself in the head. It is killing itself. And we are talking about truths that matter in this regard as to why the church is killing itself, even though it works so hard and labors so long to be the church. It is our aim to change minds by the ones and by the tens and by the hundreds and by the thousands, then by the 10,000s and then by the 100,000s. Minds need to be changed regarding the character of God, the law of God, the love of God, and the faith of Christians. What do we expect to result from this change of mind? We expect to result an awakening in the church, an awakening to the truth, an awakening by the truth. For only the truth awakens the mind. Only that which is according to the truth, the reality of things, will awaken our minds to the reality. Instead of living in denial, instead of living in something that is unreality or twisted reality, we in fact can be awakened and only by the truth. So if the church is not awakened, it must be because it is not hearing the truth. It is not living by the truth. It is not looking at the truth. After someone is awakened, after many are awakened, we expect that many will be convicted of living in sin and under the delusion that you can live in sin and still have communion with God. So many will be convicted. Some, in their conviction, will become angry. They will become angry at their pastor, their teaching that they have sat under, for not teaching them the truth. But my friend, you must go beyond anger. You must not sit in anger to those who have taught you contrary to the truth. For the truth is, you must love. You must love your neighbor. You must love your pastor. You must love those sitting next to you in your pews, in your families. You must love them. And anger has no place to promote the righteousness of God. So you must not be angry with them. In fact, anger will only come out of your own pride. Pride in what you have known and now must be discarded in view of the truth. After anger in those people, they will become and start throwing up smoke screens, excuses as to why they must not yield to the truth. However, there will be those who, after they have been awakened and convicted, will be willing to be honest with the truth, and they will become converted. They will become grateful for hearing the truth, and they will begin to take action in their love for God and love for the neighbor and begin to spread the same truth that they have heard. And those are the people that we are looking for to bring that about. We are seeking to awaken the entire church of God to the truths of the gospel. Who are we aiming at? Every person who professes Christianity, from the lowest to the highest in position in the church. We are aiming at all of them. We are aiming at all of us. We are aiming at you. Several questions that have come in on the phone this last week had to do with denomination. The question is, what denomination are you? And what are your beliefs? Well, that is not relevant. Because if we were of your denomination, you might feel safe that we are teaching the truth, but that wouldn't mean it's true. And if I am not of your denomination, then you might dismiss what I am saying because I'm not of your denomination. This is not a denominational hour. This is not a denominational issue. This is an issue of what is the truth. So do not take refuge in my denomination or lack of it. The issue is, what is the truth, my friend? What is the truth that you understand, and are you living by it? Last week, we also let it be known that for the first 50 people who write in to Gospel Truth, we will send you free one copy of a book entitled Crystal Christianity, which is a reprint of Lectures to Professing Christians by Charles Finney. That book is still available. If you will write in this week, you yourself may have a free copy. Last week in our study, we indulged further and delved further into a study of love. After the first 2 weeks, we have seen that love is a voluntary action of the will to promote the good of another for its own sake. Love, as defined from the scriptures in our study, is the commitment to promote the good of another for its own sake. Alan Alda, in an interview a number of years ago, was interviewed by Barbara Walters, and she said to him, "Does it not flatter you? Does it not make you feel good that so many millions of people love you?" And I thought that was a very wonderful question. And he answered, "No, people don't love me because they don't know me. How can they love me unless they know me?" And at the time, which was quite a number of years ago, I thought that was quite profound and quite wise. Yeah, how could they possibly love him if they don't know him? But Mr. Alda has it entirely backwards. It is not knowing a person that gives you reasons to love them. Love is what the person does towards the other person. As we found in our studies in 1 John and the 6th chapter of Luke, we discovered that love is what one does as in obedience to a command. The command of the moral law. The command of the law of God. That is, love is commanded. Therefore, it is to be given to all who are to be loved, not because you know them, but because you are required to. The law of God commands it. So Mr. Alda, or anyone else who has the opinion that people don't love them unless they know them, is entirely mistaken regarding the nature of love. In a little bit more review, we saw also that love is the commitment to promote the good of another for its own sake, without expecting anything in return. It is a commitment of the will, a voluntary act of the will. It does not take into account the character of the person that you're loving. It is a free act given as a gift to another person. It is the highest obligation of all moral agents to love others appropriately. It is the just thing to love God supremely, because his interests are supreme in importance. It is the proper thing to love my neighbor as myself, because his interests are as important as my interests are. So in review of these particulars of benevolence or love, we once again review a little bit of its nature. Now, to further understand love, and therefore our obligation, and therefore the character of God, we have to look at our moral anatomy. That is, right, you go to your doctor and you say, I have something wrong physically, and your doctor of physiology, or your medical doctor, or your chiropractor will take tests and do a diagnosis of your physical condition to find out what is physically ailing you in your anatomy. Well, we have a moral anatomy, and something goes wrong in our moral anatomy, our moral makeup, our moral nature. Let me make the distinction between the two. And here we have our introduction to the moral government of God. The moral government of God. God is the supreme being of the universe. In fact, he is the only being that existed until he made the universe. He is the only self-existent being. He has a nature and a character. This self-existent being that our minds comprehend as God created other beings, created other things. And under his creation, he is obligated to govern them. It would not be just for anyone to create something and then ignore its well-being, to ignore what would be good for it, to not watch after it in order to make sure you secure its well-being. Such is the case of two young people who might indulge in physical pleasure, produce a child, and neglect that child. The father of the child disappears. The mother of the child is trying to cope with the responsibilities of this small child. To walk away from giving birth to a child is totally irresponsible. It is totally contrary to that moral obligation to that child. And similarly, God, in creating other beings, has a responsibility to watch over their well-being and their good. And he does. This promotion of the good of all beings that he's created is called his government. It is the means by which he secures the highest good to the beings that he has created. This government of God has two aspects, two sections, two distinctions. One is physical government. All things that God has made that are under physical law are under his physical government. The other aspect of his government is moral government. All beings that God has created who are moral beings are under his moral government. Physical government has to do with anything that's under the law of cause and effect. Now, this may sound a little philosophical to you, but you're philosophical. Everybody is philosophical. In fact, the philosophy you hold regarding the nature of man determines your view of the nature of salvation and why God gives salvation and what that salvation consists of. For example, if your philosophy of man holds that man has a nature that is sinful, that transgresses the law of God, the salvation that you would contemplate must address the nature that is sinful. So your idea of man and his nature has everything to do with your concepts of what salvation would be about. So in God's creation, he has physical and moral beings. The physical beings are all those things under physical law, which could also be called the law of cause and effect, the law of necessity. These are all inanimate objects, such as rocks. These are all inanimate objects, such as stones, water. These are all animate objects, but not moral beings, such as animals. We call it the law of instinct that they operate under. That is, that they are all under a law of cause and effect, or a law of necessity. They can do no other than they do. When God created the various parts of creation, and he commanded that the trees bring forth after their kind, and the plants bring forth after their kind, and the animals bring forth after their kind, that is the law of cause and effect. That is the law of necessity. That is physical law. The plants and animals and trees can do no other than they are commanded to do. And they have been doing that for a very long time. Generation after generation, reproducing after their kind. The leaves fall out of a law of necessity. All that you see in the animal kingdom and in the material kingdom are operating under a law of necessity. They have no choice in the matter. Under moral government are all of those whom God has created that are moral beings. That is, they have the capacity to refuse to obey the law that God has given them to live by and operate under. Now, man is such a moral being. It appears that the angels are such moral beings that they have will, the ability to deny obedience to the law given to their beings by God their Creator. This law and this ability to deny obedience to this law is what makes a person, any being, a moral agent. Thus, he has what is called will. Now, it's called in theology free will, but that is rather a redundancy, is it not? For the very idea of will suggests freedom. But in theology, we call it free will, not bound will or no will. We call it free will. Free will is what every moral agent has. If you destroy free will, you destroy moral agency. The knowledge that we have free will is an intuitive knowledge. Every one of us is conscious of this fact, that we are free in our choices regarding moral obligation. Now notice, we are free in our choices regarding moral obligation. We are not free in our choices regarding physical law. We are not free to have the color of our eyes differently by an act of our will. We are not free to have a different color of hair by an act of our will. We are not free to have a different color of skin by an act of our will. We are not free under physical law to change what is under physical law by simply willing it so. Now, if somebody takes some color, hair coloring, and puts it on their hair, that's not an act of will. That is using some other instrument to try to change the color of one's hair. But by act of willing only, we cannot change. So Jesus verifies the same truth to us when he says, which one of you, by taking thought, can add one cubit to his life or change the color of his hair? That was the thought that Jesus was trying to demonstrate. Which one of you, by taking thought, can change anything that is under your physical law that is about you? So you cannot. We are bound by the color of skin that we have, the height that we have. All of our physical attributes are bound by the law of physical law, the law of necessity. Thus, because that is so, no one is guilty under moral law of the color of their skin, of the height of their head, of their gender, of their age, of their appearance. No one is guilty of whatever is under physical law in their life. The moral law does not extend to anything that is out of control and beyond the control of choices of the will. The moral law addresses only those choices that involve moral obligation. The free will of man does not, by definition, mean the ability to do what you choose to do. It does not mean the ability to choose what you to do what you choose to do. The free will of man is not a threat to the sovereignty of God. Think about that long and hard, my friend, because people who want to uphold the sovereignty of God offer a definition of free will as the ability to do whatever you want to do. But that is not the case. As I just demonstrated, you have not the ability to change anything that's under physical law. And the free will of man does not need, by definition, the ability to change anything under physical law. It only addresses those things under moral law. So that is no threat to the sovereignty of God. All of you, my friends, who have great admiration for and great reverence for the sovereignty of God, be at rest in your thinking. The free will of man does not threaten the sovereignty of God. Man is not capable of leaving this earth by an act of his will. He is not capable of doing anything that would overwhelm God and overcome God and destroy God. Man has not the ability to do that physically, and free will does not bring that about. We are talking about moral issues only. Many people deny the idea of free will of man because they say if a man has a free will, he can just save himself. We will see why that is not true. Some people think that they do not have free will because they see the misery that their sin has caused. They see their anger. They see their loss of self-respect. And they say, I didn't choose that. So I must not have a free will because I didn't choose that. Why does that come upon me? I didn't choose that. So they conclude that they are the object of and the recipient of some kind of law of cause and effect working upon them and producing in their life moral things that they are not responsible for. So today in our society in America, we have the victimization mentality that sinners are victims. Sinners are victims, recipients of so much done to them to make them sinners, that they didn't choose to be on drugs. They didn't choose to be bound to alcohol. They didn't choose to be angry with their spouse and drive them away from them and give them reasons to leave. They didn't choose these numbers of things that they're so miserable about and they feel so victimized by. And you know what? That is right. Nobody chooses to be bound to alcohol and alcoholism. Nobody chooses to be addicted to drugs. But what they do choose is to gratify their desires. In gratifying their desires leads to addiction to desires and its gratification. And the consequences they don't choose, but they do choose to gratify their desires for its own sake. And there are consequences they would never choose if they believed that they would really come about. People don't choose lung cancer, but they do choose to smoke. And in their choosing to smoke and continue choosing to smoke, they find themselves eventually addicted to nicotine to whatever degree that's possible. And they find themselves with various diseases that come upon them, such as emphysema and cancer. And they feel so sorry for themselves, as though God has brought this upon them. And they miss the cause and effect relationship between their smoking and its consequences. So they feel sorry for themselves because of the consequence of a choice. Yes, it is true, they did not directly choose to have cancer, but their choice of smoking resulted in a natural consequence that they abhor. So, in our ignorance of our moral anatomy in our day, people have lost the connection between cause and effect. They have lost it not by ignorance, really, but by living in denial. The willingness to live in self-indulgence of desires, regardless of the consequences, hoping that before they die, the miracle cure for cancer and emphysema and such as those things will be found, and they will have the privilege and the pleasure of their indulgences without the consequences. How sad it is to see people led along on that trail of misery as a consequence of their sin. Who in the world deceived these people into thinking that it's okay to live by their indulgences and that they are victims of these matters? Who in the world has done that? Where should we find them and put them in prison for leading people to think that they are victims and not the cause of their self-indulgence? Well, sadly, my friend, it is the church shooting itself in the head. It is a theology that says man has not the ability of free will to make choices. Man is a victim of a sinful nature given to him by birth. God is angry with the sinner for the nature that he has. Man can do nothing else other than what he does. That he does what he does under a law of cause and effect, forcing him to live the way he does. And he is such a pathetic victim of this sinful nature given to him by Adam so many years ago. My, what does that say about the law of God? It certainly says that the law of God is a terrible thing. But they deny the law of God in this particular view. This is a denial of the law of God. It says that since man does not have the ability to obey God, since man no longer has the ability of free will, that he cannot obey the law of God. He cannot fulfill the commandments of God to him. It is saying that he has not the ability to do what's commanded him. So why does God then command him to do so if he does not have the ability? Is God unjust in commanding somebody to do something he knows they cannot do and then threaten them with eternal death, eternal punishment? Certainly would be unjust, would it not? And yet, this particular theological view contradicts the consciousness of every man and woman in this world. Every man and woman in this world, given a moment's thought, are conscious of the fact that on moral issues, under moral obligation, things that they ought to do, they are conscious of the fact they have a choice in the matter of whether they will or will not do what they know they ought to do. For example, let's find a jury. Let's find a jury. Let's have a justice system in this country. Let's have a justice system in the whole world. Let us find a jury, 12 men good and true, with about 15 alternates, and let's let them try a very serious crime. Now, how can we possibly do that? If man is, in fact, unable to do anything other than murder, kill, steal, destroy, covet, if he has no ability to deny himself the indulgence of his flesh, the indulgence of his desire, if he has no ability to do otherwise than he does, and that is commit very serious crimes and destroy his neighbor's good, if he has no ability to do otherwise, then why do we have a justice system that has a jury, that puts people in the jury box, we present evidence to them that this crime was committed, that this person did it, and this is how he did it or she did it, and this is when he or she did it, and this is why he or she did it, and then we give the jury the responsibility to decide by the evidence whether that person should be convicted of a crime and punishment. The theology that says man has the inability to do good, to obey God, to obey his conscience, to obey the truth, nullifies the entire justice system of the whole world. It says that it is a mockery to have a justice system by trial by jury, because in the juries, they might find that the person, in fact, was responsible. They might find that the person, in fact, could have chosen not to do what he did and let him go free, let him be punished because he could have done otherwise but didn't. That would destroy the whole jury system, our whole sense of justice. For example, take another example. When people read in the newspaper or see the news on television and they see some atrocity occur, which really attacks our sense of justice, our sense of good, I think of today in our time, such as the subject of child abuse. When people contemplate a reported event that seems so outrageous, that has happened to small children, particularly by other children. People contemplate that in the abstract. There is outrage. There is outrage. When there are other crimes made by adults, they look at that and say, that person should never have done that. That person, this is what that should happen to that person for that crime. Now, why does the mind contemplate that that person should be punished? Because it is conscious of the fact that people have choices and can refrain from killing our neighbor, can refrain from stealing, can refrain from abusing others, can refrain from any treatment that is not good for one another. We know that. And that is why the world is sick of itself. That is why the world's self-esteem is at the bottom. It necessarily must be, because it has no reason to respect itself. The sinner has no reason to respect himself. You want to know the cause of the destruction of self-esteem? Used to be called self-respect. It's not poverty. It's not affluency. It's not your spouse. And it's not your children. And it's not your improductivity at work or at school. Your lack of self-esteem and self-respect is due to your conscience hammering away at you 24 hours a day, saying to you, guilty of transgressing the law of your mind. You knew how you should have treated that person, and you did not. You knew that you should have refrained from that indulgence, and you did it anyway. And it is the guilt of conscience that destroys self-esteem or self-respect. No one can view themselves respectfully while at the same time having a guilty conscience. This again proves that man knows he is free to choose between committing selfishness or refraining from selfishness. His own conscience affirms obligation and his ability to do what he's obligated to do. The theology of inability, then, is a justification of sin. It is the great justification for sin. It is the anointed justification for sin because it is in a theological form. When I hear preachers preach and teach on the radio, some of them are excellent, much better than myself in preaching and teaching and in their style and in their way and in the presentation, much better than myself that I could ever believe I could possibly be with many years of study. And they lay out wonderful truths regarding how we ought to love our neighbor and what that would be like and loving God and obedience to Him, and God requires obedience. But sadly, they turn their theological dial to a different number in their mind somehow and issue forth this inability doctrine. And they would say, however, we are really not able to do what our conscience tells us we know we ought to do. We are not really able to do what the law of God commands us to do. We are not really able to do what we affirm to each other that we ought to do. And it is the great justification for people to walk out of church or put a book down and say, well, thank God, I'm not responsible because I'm not able. The great and actually the only excuse for not obeying moral obligation is inability. If inability can be established, then a man is not responsible for his actions. In fact, if he is unable to obey moral obligation, if he is unable to love God with all of his heart, if he is unable to love his neighbor as himself, you know what? He doesn't have to. He is not obligated to. Because the moral law addresses those under it who have the ability to refuse to obey it. And if you do not have that ability, you truly are not obligated to do so. But if you did have the inability to obey God, your conscience wouldn't condemn you either. Your conscience could not condemn you if you did not have the ability to obey its dictates. Notice a small child. When you're training your children, and by the way, moral government and his teachings are the most excellent understanding of training your children up in the way they should go. But if you take a small child that you've been training to understand and do what he ought to do for his good, for the development of his character and preparation for himself in life, when he knows that he has done something wrong, what is one of the first things he tries to offer as an excuse to let himself off the hook for any discipline that he might receive? Is the excuse of inability. Either the inability that he didn't know, though you may know he did know, or the inability physically to refrain or to do. Inability is the excuse that is offered to justify oneself. The inability of knowing or the inability of doing. It is the great justification. Had no theologians come along and put theologically together the idea of inability, the idea is around anyway. Because it is the great excuse of sinners who come under conviction. It is the great excuse that sinners give trying to deny their responsibility before the law of God and the law of their mind by offering the excuse of inability. It is the sinner's religion. It is its key doctrine, the doctrine of inability. No theologian has to create that doctrine. It is created by the sinner, refusing to yield to God, the doctrine of inability. Because if it is true, it is a perfect excuse. God himself would never condemn a person who could not obey the moral law. Every being that watched God, if a man or woman came up before the judgment And God looked at him and says, I knew you could not keep my law, but I punish you anyway. The whole universe would convulse with seeing that injustice. And that truly is injustice if God were to do that. But God will not do that. God will take no one who is unable to obey and convict them of sin. But man does have the freedom to choose to obey moral obligation, and he knows it. It is part of our moral anatomy, the ability to choose. The ability to choose to obey or disobey known moral obligation. One of the conditions for moral obligation is knowledge or light. Knowledge, or the Bible calls it light, truth, knowledge. It is he who knows to do good and does not do it. To him it is sin. If there is no knowledge of obligation, then there is no duty. And if there is no duty, there is no sin. And therefore there would be no punishment. Moral obligation is conditioned upon knowledge of the obligation. It is conditioned upon knowledge and light of his duty. To the extent you know what you ought to do, to that extent you are obligated to do it, and to that extent your guilt is measured. No more and no less. No less and no more. To the extent you know. Listen carefully. This is wonderful news. Some people think that you are obligated to do that which is beyond your ability to know. Some people think you must have the knowledge that God has of obligation in order to have the proper knowledge of obligation. But the measure of your guilt and obligation is what you know you ought to be and to do. Paul, in the first chapter of Romans, deals with this very explicitly. He describes the guilt of the Gentiles based upon their understanding and light from creation. He says that from the creation, not from the time of creation, but from the creation as perceived by the Gentiles that have lived throughout the world and through all time. He says, according to the creation, they have a knowledge of God's eternal power and his invisible attributes and his divine nature. That by looking at creation, knowing that you didn't create it, knowing that your neighbor didn't create it, there must be a creator with much more power than is evident in the creation. There is a knowledge of divine nature, a knowledge of his power, and his invisible attributes, sufficient to impose obligation upon the observer of nature to look, seek out and find what this being, this great creator, requires of them. In fact, the knowledge that there is a creator imposes obligation. And creation itself imposes upon the mind of the observer the knowledge that there is a creator. And that imposes the obligation to give him his due regard and his according to his interests. The creation itself, Paul says, imposes obligation upon the observer, sufficient obligation to put obligation upon him in a relationship to the Creator. So that the Gentiles who did not have the revealed law through Moses, who did not have the prophetic promises through the prophets, who did not have the knowledge of God through the temple and the sacrifices, had enough knowledge of God to impose upon them the obligation to promote his interests above their own. That limited amount of light, Paul says, is what the Gentiles, without a knowledge of revealed truth, will be judged by. In the second chapter, he clearly says that their own consciences will either approve or disapprove, and that God will judge them, who knows the intents of the heart, God will judge them by the light that they have. And then you go into the second chapter at the end, and he talks about the nation of Israel, who had much greater light, and God says that they will be judged by a greater light. So that guilt is measured by the amount of light that you have and not by any outward action. It is according to the light that one has. whether one has sinned or not. Well, how much light do you have? What is it that you know you ought to do and be? What is it you know that you ought to love above everything else? Do you not know that you must love God above everything else, since He as a being is superior in His being, and that His interests are far above yours? Does that not dictate to you enough light to know that living for yourself supremely is contrary to what you know in reality exists? The very idea of God and your neighbor imposes upon all of us the obligation. So why do people go to hell? Why are people punished with eternal damnation? Not because they refused Jesus Christ. Some people say that people go to hell because they refuse Jesus Christ. No, they go to hell because they refuse the light that they have. They transgress the knowledge of the light that they have. Look at the first and second chapter of the book of Romans. It is the transgression of the amount of light that you have regarding your obligation to God. For example, let us say you lived by yourself, not even with your family. You lived in a farmhouse by yourself and you had no knowledge that there was any other moral beings around you. All there were was trees and cattle and a beautiful landscape. And you had no knowledge that there was any other being in existence. And on the weekend, a family shows up across the road and starts to build a house across the road from you. And you look at them and you see them. Once you know that they are there, nothing will be the same. The knowledge that you now have other beings that exist, and you know it, imposes upon you the obligation to do one of two things. You will either treat them as you would want to be treated, or you will treat them by ignoring them. You will treat them by ignoring the benevolence you ought to give them and the good that you ought to promote to them. You cannot remain neutral once you know that you have a neighbor. By the very law of our beings and our minds, we are under obligation once we know that there are other moral beings out there, such as ourselves. That is the source. That is where the law, the moral law, comes from. It is the nature we have and our relationships we have one with another. By the natures we have, we perceive our neighbors. By the natures we have, it imposes upon us the obligation to do them good instead of harm them. Everyone acknowledges it is, and we ought to, do good to someone instead of harm them. That is but an expression of the moral law imposed upon us by our own reason. So that everyone has, by their own light of reason, Paul instructs us and our consciousness affirms, we know that if we have neighbors, we ought to treat them good instead of treating them harmfully. This is a consciousness of the moral law written upon our minds, as Paul says, regarding the Gentiles. And that is the measure of your obligation, and that is the measure of your guilt if you do not do them kindly instead of doing them harmfully. Now, what about our relationship with God? As Paul describes, looking at creation, we see we have a much more powerful, much more beautiful, much more wise, much more intelligent neighbor than the guy who's going to build a farmhouse across the street from us. We see in creation we have a neighbor that is awesome. We have a neighbor that is infinite. We have a neighbor that is powerful. We have a neighbor that is wise. We have a neighbor that understands beauty. We have a neighbor that understands design. We have an intelligent, designful neighbor who made us all. That dictates to us that we must either treat him one way or the other. We must either give him what is due him according to his nature and his stature and his interests, or we will deny those. And that is but the moral law speaking to us. And when we deny our neighbor and our infinite neighbor what is due them, our conscience is like a judge pounding the gavel in our mind, saying, you are guilty of only serving yourself. You are guilty of not being just and giving what is truly due your neighbor. you are guilty of not giving what is justly owed God, our infinite neighbor. So the law of God is not created by the will of God and just commanding us to do something arbitrarily. The law of God, the moral law, comes out of the very nature and relations of moral beings, as I have described it and illustrated it for you. The law of God is beautiful. Some people read Romans chapter 7, and they get a picture of the law of God as something so terrible, something so bad, because they read Romans chapter 7, and the person in there is talking about how the law of God, well, he calls it holy, just, and good, but he's not living according to it. And that sounds like a real burden to him. It sounds like shackles around his feet, and some theologians portray the law of God as something just so terrible that God is saving us from the law. But that's not true. God is saving us from sin, transgression of the law. God is not saving us from his law. He's saving us to his law. God is not saving us from the commandment, which is holy, just, and good. He is saving us to the commandment to do that which is holy, just, and good. As Paul says in Romans chapter 8, that the very requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us, Romans 8:4, that's why Christ suffered and died, that the very requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us. Not to save us from the law, but that the very requirement, that is to love God with all of our heart and love our neighbor as ourselves, that it might be fulfilled in us, that it would really live within us, that the spirit of the law would be written on our heart as the new covenant promised. Now, when people think about the law of God, the Ten Commandments, all summed up in the commandment to love, and they think about Romans chapter 7, and they hear the theology that the law is something that God has came to save us from, it's pretty hard to understand passages like Psalms 119, isn't it? Oh, this is the Psalm 119, the longest chapter in the Bible. Psalm 119 says, "Oh, how I love thy law. It is my meditation all the day." That's verse 97. Verse 77, "May thy compassion come to me that I may live, for thy law is my delight. And I shall lift," verse 48, "and I shall lift up my hands to thy commandments, which I love." Oh my, you read Psalms 119, and you will find a man who absolutely adores and loves and delights and lives by the law of God. Verse 113, "I hate those who are double-minded, but I love thy law." Oh, how wonderful is the law of God! Because it is only suited to our nature and our relations. It only commands that which the nature that he has made with us affirms to be right and just and good and holy. What a wonderful thing that God has made us in such a way that the law of our being and the law of his being are under the same law. Why? Because he has made us in his image. God has created man in his image. Obviously, we don't have infinite number of toes and hands and infinite length of arms. We don't have a mind that is infinite in knowledge nor infinite in wisdom. So we are not made in God's image as to his physical nature. Now, by physical nature, I do not mean that God has a physical body. But what I mean is his natural attributes. Those attributes of God that he has by the very fact that he exists. They were not created. He did not choose to be eternal. He is eternal. He did not choose to be infinite in his wisdom. He simply is infinite in his wisdom. These are natural attributes of God that God did not choose to have, nor did he create in himself. His character is not his natural attributes, but his moral attributes. God's moral attributes are something that he is voluntarily having. He voluntarily is benevolent. He voluntarily is benevolent and disinterestedly so. He voluntarily is committed to promoting good for its own sake. He voluntarily sent his Son. He did not have to. It has not come out of his nature, but out of his heart, voluntarily. His love, as well as our love, is voluntary. And that's a beautiful thing about the benevolence of God. God is not a big mechanism, a big machine, whereby he is pumping out what we call love. But he is just doing it because he has to. The love of God himself is voluntary. The man, going back to bring us back to the subject at hand that we've been discussing, man has a free will which makes him able to obey the obligation that he understands in his mind. The light that every one of us has is the measure of our obligation and the measure of our guilt if there is disobedience. Now, this is a wonderful truth, the law of God, because the law of God does not command you to do anything you cannot do. And there is a belief in the world called perfectionism that has as its core the belief that you can do more than you can do. Now, I know just saying that sounds absurd, but there are millions of people who believe that it is true, that they believe that they can be in two places at once, and therefore they must be in two places at once. They believe that God requires them to do more than they can do. So they are put under some kind of pseudo-obligation to do more than they're able to do. But God does not require us to do more than we are able to do. God does not require us to lift a stone we cannot lift. God does not require us to go someplace we cannot get to. God only requires that we love him supremely and love our neighbor as ourselves, according to the ability that we have. Have you seen the Special Olympics? These wonderful children of various ages with great disabilities. And they have the Special Olympics and the running competition or the jumping competition or whatever. And you see the child and the signal is to go and they start running. And you can see that their performance is greatly lacking. But you can also see that they gave all that they had. And that's what the law of God addresses. Thou shalt love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. And you need not love him with more than your all, because all is enough. And looking into the Special Olympics, an example of this, to me it's a perfect example of any man or woman looking and running the race set before them. If you do it with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, if you're devoting all of your abilities and capabilities and assets to the glory of God and promoting his interests, and if you're loving your neighbor as yourself, that is the fulfillment of the law. And as Paul says in Romans chapter 13, love does no ill to its neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. My friends, a wonderful truth for you to know today. You can have the law fulfilled in your life. The very requirement of the law can be fulfilled in us, who walk not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Romans chapter 8. Paul says, love does no ill to its neighbor, therefore love is, present tense, the fulfilling of the law. You can, in fact, my friend, fulfill the law. Now, again, we're not talking about getting saved. We're talking about knowing and doing the will of God. Salvation is a gift through the gospel, and we shall look at that at further. But we need to understand what salvation is needed. We are not to be saved from the law. We are not to be saved from our nature. We are to be saved from our disobedience. It is our known, willful choice to indulge ourselves instead of obey the commands of our mind and the command of God to love him with all of our heart. That's what we need to be saved from. And the gospel of Jesus Christ is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek, and it saves us not from the law, but from sin. And thank God for such a gospel.